the strong economic power never give up. And on the other hand, we need to get our share from the world. Okay, and I think nobody wants to fight. So we have to try more and more to provide some products. In my opinion, our products would be the best or the first in a product. If you do this, you can hope to you can hope other people buy your product.
Let's switch now to Mahdi in his second feature of the two-part coverage that he did on the Expo 2023. Mahdi, what do you have for us in this segment?
And now I'm joined by a businessman from the African country of Uganda, Mr. Jamil. Mr. Jamil, yes. Please introduce yourself and your company to our viewers.
My name is Dr. Jamil Sebaru. I'm the president of the Uganda Farmers Dialogue. I work with farmers and I work with the business people. In my country, I represent about 7,500 farmers. That's why I'm here. I want to thank Mugarabi Technical Ventures Africa because they are the people who organized this and invited us to come. This is a great opportunity for all of us in Africa because we've been looking for a way of getting our products to Iran, but also getting products from Iran to our country.
Exactly.
Okay? And this is an opportunity now. The difference between so many products that we are getting in our countries is the quality. Uh-huh. We understand that the quality in Iran is a very good quality. Mm-hmm. The issue of prices is not a problem. The biggest problem is quality. And when we talk about Uganda, we are talking about all the other countries surrounding Uganda, uh-huh. including Kenya, Tanzania, Congo, South Africa, all those countries. We are the food basket.
Welcome to the Quick Tech section. I'm Mahdi Abbasian. Iran's economy is set to explode based on participation of regional countries like Iran's increased exposure, as seen in this Expo 2023. Let's take a look at the budget, then GDP performance, to see the potential of Iran's trade advancement. On December 12th, Raisi presented a draft budget for 2022-2023 to Parliament. Raisi's first budget was the opposite of the former president's final budget. Instead of betting on sanctions relief, Raisi planned for a continuation of U.S. sanctions and set modest targets for oil exports, but it set a higher target for non-oil exports. Government spending was set to increase by 9%, but considering that annual inflation hovered around 40% in December, the government actually cut expenditures in real terms. And how has Raisi done that? Iran's gross domestic product reached nearly 55,000 trillion riyals, or about $14 billion, in the 9 months to December 21, 2022, showing an increase of 5.1% against the similar period in 2020. The highest GDP growth in the Iranian economic sector in March to December was reported for manufacturing and mining as the sector expanded by 7.1%. The Iranian services sector grew by 5.1% over the same period, while the agriculture sector, a best performer of the economy in recent years, contracted by 3.9%. That's the end of this segment of the program.
Time now to bring in a couple more of the attendees of the Expo 2023. Joining us in this segment, we have Hamza Imran Rauf, from the Alhambra Trading Company. He's a manager there, and he attended the Iran Expo 2023. Welcome to the program. Let me start out by getting your impression about how you have this huge expo, 800 domestic and foreign companies that participated, showcasing their products and achievements. Tell us about the products and service that you offered and how obviously Iran's market can be to your advantage.
Okay, as I can see in international market, the cost of processing and finishing the product is very high. And now in Iran, we have this potential that is a point, good point for us. We can find everything here with low price. So the processing price and the cost and also finishing product is very cheap when you compare it with other market in the world. So the quality also, yeah, we can say acceptable for market. Sometimes we need to add some standards for that those markets, but so far, as I can see, everything is, I mean, are good enough to send them to other countries.
All right, thank you so much for that. We do appreciate it. Let me bring in our next guest for this segment. Let's see who we have. We have from the general manager of the company by the name of FAUEA. He is Fu Ilan. And the company name is Ferro Alloy United East Asia. Who joins us? Or is it Fujian? I'm sorry if I'm pronouncing that properly. Welcome to Economic Divide. We'd like to get an idea from you in terms of how Iran obviously is known for its petrochemicals and oil. But Iran's manufacturing is not just about that. And it covers a wide array of products. Tell us how you could interact with Iran when it comes to bilateral trade, both from what you offer and then from what Iran can offer you.
I have to say that it's a very successful exhibition, especially the Salon 41, collect all the provinces together, all the, investment office, the governors. In this way, people don't have to go around all Iran to search the locations. They just come in one lobby, and they will see how whole opportunities in Iran. And that's why we came here, and fortunately we found this Tabliz, and we hope to very soon start our future plant in here. If we really join in such exhibitions, we will see actually the products and the companies from Iran are brilliant in the world. So I hope there are more and more such exhibitions could successfully open again and again, so more and more people, foreigners, and will listen to the voice of Iran and will see your products, and it's one important step. You are going to go to the world again.
Iran is a country with vast resources, not only in the oil and petrochemical sectors. Given that it has been under sanctions for decades, its full potential has not been met, not even close. Well, this administration, headed by President Ebrahim Raisi, is determined to raise Iran's revenues by increasing Iran's trade. Iran Trade Expo 2023 is a perfect example of how it is doing this when it comes to non-oil exports. Tell us what you thought about the program. This was a big deal for Iran in terms of the number of countries in attendance and, of course, with the goal of expanding trade relations. From Mikhail Tagli and the entire team here at Economic Divide, it's goodbye until the next program.
insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Suratul Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses and then we'll be back. So stay with us.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
Wa huwa alladhi yuhyi wa yumeetu wa lahu ikhtilafu al-layli wan nahar afala taqilun.
And it is he who gives life and causes death, and his is the alternation of the night and the day. Then will you not reason?
As you have been previously with us, dear listeners, you already know that we were talking about the 80th verse of the chapter. وَهُوَ الَّذِي يُحْيِي وَيُمِيتُ. And he it is who gives life and death. وَلَهُ اخْتِلَافُ اللَّيْلِ وَالنَّهَارِ. And unto him belongs the alteration of night and the day. أَفَلَا تَعْقِلُونَ. Have you then no sense? So, the ending part of the verse was here to tell us that all the factors and mercies of the Almighty Allah mentioned in the previous verses as well as in this verse are serving to guide us to knowing and thanking the Almighty Allah. So, at the end it says, أَفَلَا تَعْقِلُونَ. Have you no sense? The Holy Prophet ﷺ, on the importance of intellect, has said, intellect is something by which paradise will be detained and through which the pleasure of Almighty Allah is achieved. As the words of the infallible Imams read, we understand that by means of intellect, we can achieve that by means of intellect, we can achieve both the goodness and reward of this world and hereafter. And it is reflected in our traditions that the one who has no intellect is deprived of the benefits and advantages of them altogether. Imam Ridha alayhi salam has said, "The intellect is the friend of every man, and his enemy is his ignorance. One cannot overcome the world except by the power of intellect." And that's the reason the Almighty Allah starts naming different mercies from his side. And at the end he says, أَفَلَا تَعْقِلُونَ. In this regard, the Holy Prophet ﷺ has said, everything has a tool and support, and the believer's tool and support is the intellect. Everything has a vehicle, and man's vehicle is intellect.
الزمان تألقا وأضاء للدنيا طريقا.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
Brothers and sisters, it seems that the Holy Prophet ﷺ is telling us that what drives us, what pushes us forward in our life, both in this world and hereafter, is the intellect. So we should learn how to use it. The Prophet ﷺ continues, "Everything has an end, and the end of worship is intellect." It seems that only through intellect we can achieve the highest station of mercy, close to the Almighty Allah. The Holy Prophet says, "Every nation has a guardian, and the guardian of worshippers is the intellect." The Holy Prophet says that we should be thoughtful of what transactions our community has, with which communities we have relationships, and which communities and which societies do we hold as hostilities. The Holy Prophet says, "Every merchant has a capital, and the capital of the strivers is the intellect. Every ruined is mended by something, and the hereafter is mended by the intellect. And every traveler has a tent in which he takes refuge, and the tent of the Muslim is his intellect." Brothers and sisters, we have many traditions upon the importance of intellect, and that the true Muslim has to use this mercy of the Almighty Allah in order to reach him. And that is when he can use the mercies that the Almighty Allah has given him. The mercies previously mentioned. وَالَّذِي أَنْشَأَ لَكُمُ السَّمْعَ وَالْأَبْصَارَ وَالْأَفْئِدَةَ. He is the one who produced for you hearing, eyes and hearts. وَهُوَ الَّذِي ذَرَأَكُمْ فِي الْأَرْضِ. He multiplied you in the earth. These were all mentioned in the previous verses by saying قَلِيلًا مَا تَشْكُرُونَ. Very little of you give thanks. But afterwards, the Almighty Allah said that you shall be mustered unto him, and at the end, أَفَلَا تَعْقِلُونَ, which means that all of the previously mentioned mercies were here to tell us that we must have intellect. Otherwise, we shall be punished, and the chastisement of the unbelievers awaits us as well. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. وَالسَّلَامُ عَلَيْكُمْ وَرَحْمَةُ اللَّهِ وَبَرَكَاتُهُ.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. this life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Things always worked for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
Imam Sajjad, peace be upon him, has said, "Whenever I remembered the martyrdom of the children of Fatima, peace be upon her, my eyes filled with tears."
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladheena amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi.
The theme that I've been talking about in this majalis is basically to see those who are close to Amir al-Mu'mineen so that we can relate to them, look at them as role models and examples of what does it mean to be Shia of Ali. Ammar bin Yasir is known as one of the Al-Arkan al-Arba'a, one of the four pillars of the support of Amir al-Mu'mineen. Ammar, you know, he has been praised by the Prophet in many different ways. There is one hadith accepted by Shias and Sunnis both where the Prophet says, اشتاقت الجنة إلى علي وعمار وسلمان وبلال. The Jannah is waiting or longing for Ali, Ammar, Salman, and Bilal. One day Ammar came to visit the Prophet, so he basically asked permission from outside that I would like to come in. And the Prophet told his servant there, إِذَنُ لَهُ, allow him to come. But then the way he addressed him, he says, مَرْحَبَا بِالطَّيِّبِ ابْنَ الطَّيِّبِ. You know, Ammar is tayyib, pure, and he is son of a pure one. When the Masjid al-Nabi was being built, at the time, even the Prophet was, you know, helping his companions. At that time, there was some argument, and I don't want to go into details. We don't have that much time today, where somebody criticized Ammar. And Ammar was actually carrying double of the load of others, not one brick, two bricks, for example. And so when there was one of the prominent Sahaba was basically was you know criticizing him. So Rasulullah said, leave him alone. And he called Ammar close, and he wiped the sweat from his forehead. And then the Prophet says, you know, that he is someone, إِنَّكَ مِنْ أَهْلِ الْجَنَّةِ تَقْتُلُكَ الْفِئَةُ الْبَاغِيَةِ. You are from the people of Jannah, and you will be killed by a rebellious group. In what state? Ammar will be killed, يَدْعُوهُمْ إِلَى الْجَنَّةِ, while he will be calling them towards Jannah, and those who killed him, يَدْعُونَ إِلَى النَّارِ, will be calling him towards Jahannam. And this hadith was there at that time, but it became a very crucial point in the discussion between Shias and Sunnis later on. And you see that, you know, he was among those who were with Amir al-Mu'mineen in the house of Fatima al-Zahra to protest against the bay'at of Abu Bakr. And even after that, especially during the time of Uthman, he was a very strong, you know, vocal critique of the unjust policies of Uthman about the way mismanaging the Baytul Mal, the public treasury. For example, Arqam bin Abdullah, who was the treasurer during the time of Uthman, one day Uthman told him to, you know, set aside 100,000 dirham. He said, I can do that, but I'll make a note that this is a loan that you have from Baytul Mal. And Uthman became very angry. He said, what do you mean? You are my treasurer. He said, no, I'm not your treasurer. I am treasurer of the Muslims. You appointed me to handle Baytul Mal. This is public's property. And he became so angry, abused him, you know, and dismissed him. Rather, I would say, you know, the treasurer quit. He said, I cannot do any work with you anymore. And then Uthman goes on the minbar and he says, O people, when Abu Bakr came, he preferred his tribe over others. When Umar came, he preferred his tribe over others. And therefore, I will prefer my own tribe of Banu Umayyah over others. And nobody can say anything about what I'm doing. If I'm given the right to be at the door of Jannah, and the privilege to admit people, I will bring all the Banu Umayyah into Jannah. Look at their affiliations. And this is whether people like or not, this is our property. And this is where, when Ammar heard about it, one of the cases where he openly opposed Uthman was on this issue. Where Uthman comes down from the minbar and starts, you know, kicking Ammar, to the extent that Ammar became unconscious. You know, they talk about Shias being, you know, oh, they don't believe in Sahaba, don't respect Sahaba. What is this? You know, and this is where the story goes on. You know, he even decided then to exile Ammar the way Abu Zar was exiled. Until Banu Makhzum, the tribe that he was affiliated to, they came to Ali, said, can you go and, you know, convince Uthman not to do this? And because of the words of Amir al-Mu'mineen, Uthman let him stay in Medina. The hadith of the Prophet about Ammar, that, you know, you will be killed by the rebellious group. This became a problem because Ammar was with Amir al-Mu'mineen in Siffin. And he was killed in Siffin, at the hand of the forces of Muawiyah there. And at that time, many people didn't remember that hadith of Rasulullah about Ammar. But the day he was killed, Abdullah bin Amr ibn As, son of Amr ibn As, who used to write the hadith of Rasulullah for his own notes, immediately said, oh, Rasulullah said that he will be killed by the rebellious group. So even those who are still, you know, on the fence on this issue of who is on haq, who is on batil in Safin, on that day they realize haq is with Ali and Muawiyah is batil. And when Abdullah bin Amr ibn As mentioned this hadith, remembered that, it became like a wildfire among the Syrian forces. And Muawiyah told Amr ibn As, can you not put a rein on the mouth of your son? Why does he have to say everything that he heard from Rasulullah? Because it became a public relations nightmare for him. And Amr ibn As says, well, there is a solution to it. Why don't you spread words among your soldiers that the person responsible for the killing of Ammar is the person who brought him to Safin? You know, this crooked thinking of blaming the victim. That we didn't kill him, the responsibility goes on the person who brought him here. When Amir al-Mu'minin heard about it, he laughed. He said, it means Rasulullah is responsible for the killing of Hamza, because he took his uncle to Uhud. And this is where, you know, we see that this hadith even now becomes, even the shahadat of Ammar became a point of support for the vilayat of Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salatu.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمن
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Shock and desperation. Children traumatized. Mothers losing their children. Israel claims it is not targeting civilians, but the injured and the dead tell another story. Like dead Palestinian girl carried by her father. With over 100 wounded, how many times will Israel kill civilians like women and children, yet claim it is targeting resistance fighters and leaders? When is it enough?
Are you ready to say enough is enough? As the highest authority responsible for the maintenance of international peace and security?
As of Saturday, May 13, Israel has so far assassinated 6 Islamic Jihad leaders, and it has stated it is after more blood. The killing machine has no mercy. One bombing operation involved 40 aircrafts and drones, courtesy of the United States. The incessant sound of drones creates a constant state of terror, panic, and anxiety among the 2 million people living in the Gaza Strip. Al-Mizan, a human rights group based in Gaza, notes that between the years 2000 and 2023, at least 2,148 Palestinians, including 378 children and 86 women, were killed by Israeli drones. Nearly 350 were killed inside their homes, including more than 100 children, underscoring the reality that there is no safe place in Gaza. And these are conservative figures. Resistance groups in the Gaza Strip have not stood idle. Palestinian factions, like the Islamic Jihad, said they are united in their joint response. Resistance factions have been relentless in their rocket attacks. Many have reached as far as Tel Aviv, or close to it, like the town, which claimed the life of one Israeli, injuring five others. Israel getting a taste of its own medicine. As a matter of fact, the resistance group's firepower has overwhelmed Israel's so-called Iron Dome system. In one tally, more than 500 rockets were fired at Israel. Of these, 368 rockets made it over the border, and 154 were intercepted by the so-called Iron Dome missile defense system. Simple math shows that this dome had a 30% success rate. And Israel better be careful. Reports indicate it has so far only hit Islamic Jihad targets. Israel knows that Palestinian resistance groups are believed to be capable of firing thousands of rockets, which could quickly exhaust Israel's Iron Dome anti-missile system. On top of that, Israel is unable to sustain prolonged disruption to its civilian economy amid widespread fear and panic among its population. Israel is now at its weakest. Regionally, it is isolated more than ever. Iran and Saudi Arabia's reconciliation have solidified the axis of resistance, especially after Saudi Arabia hosted Hamas recently and is warming up to Hezbollah. And from within, Israel is unraveling due to the revolt by Israelis against the judicial reforms. Protests now in its fourth month. There's growing consensus that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu launched the assault on Gaza to appease his fractious, extreme coalition, particularly Itamar Ben-Gavir, in order to distract from the protests. Yet Netanyahu may be risking it all when the Tel Aviv skyline is filled with too many rockets that would rain down and eliminate its presence on Palestinian land. The U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen urged Congress to raise the $31.4 trillion debt limit and avert an unprecedented default, saying that a failure to do so would have dire consequences. Yellen's comments come after she warned of an economic catastrophe if the U.S. fails to raise its debt ceiling in the coming weeks. She has also previously warned that the U.S. could fail to meet its debt obligations sooner than expected, and it may run out of measures as early as June 1. Yellen issued the latest in a series of increasingly stark warnings in remarks prepared for a press conference meeting in Japan with her counterparts from the Group of Seven G7 rich nations, as well as India, Indonesia, and Brazil. Yellen's comments came as a political stalemate over raising the debt limit was forcing the Treasury Department dangerously close to worst-case scenario, which is a potential U.S. debt default.
The notion of defaulting on our debt is something that would so badly undermine the U.S. and global economy that I think it should be regarded by everyone as unthinkable.
In order to avoid a default on the nation's debt, Congress must vote to either raise or suspend the debt limit before the Treasury runs out of emergency funding. But with only days left this month, time is running out to reach a deal. Democratic leaders are calling for the limit to be raised, but Republicans want spending cuts and other conditions to be agreed first. The last time this happened, the U.S. saw its credit rating downgraded and interest rates on its existing debt go up. Even if the nation avoids tumbling over the fiscal cliff, the U.S. economy could suffer.
They're doing the best, to the best of my knowledge, what no other political party has done in the nation's history. They're literally, not figuratively, holding the economy hostage by threatening to default on our nation's debt that we've already incurred.
Thank you. The debt ceiling is the maximum amount the U.S. government is legally authorized to borrow to meet its obligations. Many investors are bracing for the economic fallout of the deadline for the U.S. to raise the debt ceiling or default on its obligations. The U.S. government has run a deficit averaging nearly $1 trillion every year since the year 2001, meaning that it spends that much more money than it receives in taxes and other revenues.
Congress has told Treasury, you should pay our bills, you should pay our debt. But at the same time, it's told it, you can't borrow anymore to pay those bills and debt. And at the same time, Congress has authorized all of the spending that's being done. So the spending's going out the door. The bills are showing up at Treasury, and Treasury isn't getting in enough revenue from taxpayers to pay the bills. And so there's a lot of hand-wringing over what Treasury should do.
Even short of a default, hitting the debt ceiling would stop the government's ability to finance its operations, including providing for the national defense or funding entitlements such as Medicare or Social Security. The default could cause the loss of 3 million jobs, add $130,000 to the cost of an average 30-year mortgage, and raise interest rates enough to increase the national debt by $850 billion. Meanwhile, the recent turmoil in the banking industry have concerned investors. In early May, officials closed San Francisco-based First Republic Bank, making it the third U.S. bank to collapse in the past 2 months. Most of First Republic's assets are being acquired by J.P. Morgan, Silicon Valley Bank, and Signature Bank, whose clients were mostly from the tech industry, collapsed in March under similar circumstances. But they are not alone. The U.S. Federal Reserve has revealed that 722 banks reported unrealized losses exceeding 50% of their capital at the end of the third quarter of 2022. Those losses have occurred because banks bought lots of treasuries and bonds when interest rates were near zero. Now, as the Federal Reserve raises rates to combat inflation, the value of these bonds has declined.
Israel has kept pounding the Gaza Strip, targeting areas in the southern part of the besieged Palestinian territory. It came after the Israeli military conducted airstrikes against the Gaza Strip, assassinating senior Islamic Jihad officials.
The Israeli occupation committed a great crime and treacherous aggression against our people in the Gaza Strip by bombing residential areas and homes, which led to the killing of children and women and targeted the leaders of the resistance. Our people and the resistance know how to respond to this great crime and make the occupation pay the price for this aggression on the Gaza Strip.
Palestinian resistance groups in Gaza have fired rockets towards Israeli sites in retaliation for the regime's deadly air raids, hitting targets as far as Tel Aviv. Gaza's Joint Command of Palestinian Resistance Groups claimed responsibility for firing rockets at Israel, saying in a statement it had fired hundreds of rockets towards the occupied Palestinian territories, including Tel Aviv, in an operation codenamed Revenge of the Free. Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh has warned that Israel will pay the price for the killings. The Palestinian resistance group Lion's Den has warned the Tel Aviv regime of surprise and unprecedented retaliatory attacks after the assassination of high-profile resistance commanders in Israeli airstrikes. Iran, Lebanon, Egypt, Jordan, amongst many Muslim countries, and the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, or the OIC, condemned in separate statements the Israeli aggression on the besieged Gaza Strip. High-profile commanders of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad resistance movement have been assassinated after Israeli military aircraft launched a series of targeted strikes on the Gaza Strip days after a fiery flare-up of violence set the besieged coastal area on edge. Alongside the assassinations, military compounds and a military position belonging to the Islamic Jihad were targeted as well. The Islamic Jihad resistance commanders in the strikes include Khalil Bahitini, the commander of the Al-Quds Brigades in the northern Gaza Strip, Tariq Izzeddin, a spokesperson for the movement, and Jihad Al-Ghannam, secretary of the movement's military council. Bahitini was the most senior operational commander in the Islamic Jihad and was responsible for the rocket fire towards occupied territories in the past month. Izzeddin was responsible for the communications between the movements and its branches in the West Bank and for transferring funds and coordinating resistance active in the occupied lands. Ghannam was one of the most senior and veteran operatives in Islamic Jihad and served at one point as the commander of the Al-Quds Brigades in the southern Gaza Strip.
This enemy is a criminal entity ever since it was created on the land of Palestine. It assassinated leaders in their homes with their families and children. They did not assassinate them in the battlefield, not in the streets or cars. They assassinated them while they were with their children and killed their children and women along with them.
Meanwhile, Israeli troops have shot dead two young Palestinian men during a military raid in the occupied West Bank city of Kabatia, the latest in a year-long spike of violence that shows no sign of abating. The Israeli military said it conducted a raid in the early hours of Wednesday on Kabatia, situated 6 kilometers south of Jenin. The Palestinian Ministry of Health identified the victims as 19-year-old Ahmed Jamal Asif and 24-year-old Warani Walid Katanat. Another Palestinian was injured in the assault. Witnesses said a large number of Israeli forces raided Kabatia and broke into several homes in the western neighborhood of the West Bank city. They violently searched the buildings and ransacked all properties before leaving. The Israeli forces then closed the main streets in the town while laying siege to a number of houses. The regime has stepped up attacks across the occupied territories over the past months. More than 100 Palestinians have been killed in the occupied West Bank so far this year.
The gun violence nightmare continues in the U.S. 8 people were shot and several others wounded by a gunman at a busy mall north of Dallas, Texas. The gunman, whom authorities said they believe acted alone, was killed by a police officer after he began firing outside of the mall. He was wearing tactical gear and carrying an AR-15-style rifle during the attack. One young eyewitness described the horrifying moments as the shooting unfolded, including the terrifying sounds of the gunfire, and she remains fearful that such an attack could reoccur.
When I heard it, it was like really loud. It kept going like, poof, poof, poof. And what my dad heard, it was like a pling in a car. And then when we were running, the shot got closer to us, like really, really close. And I thought they were running towards us since we were all running around and there were more people running around us. I felt really scared because many people were running for their lives and some people didn't survive. Some got injured. I'm still feeling scared because it could happen to us at school. It could happen to us at another mall.
Reports say the social media accounts of the shooter contained hundreds of posts with racially or ethnically motivated content and violent far-right rhetoric. The reports say the Dallas attacker may have been linked to white supremacist or neo-Nazi groups. Texas Governor Greg Abbott called the shooting an unspeakable tragedy.
Texans are hurting today, and the people who are hurting the most, obviously, are the families of the victims. Families who've lost a loved one, families who have a loved one who is injured.
Abbott also said there has been a dramatic increase in the amount of anger and violence that's taking place in America. He said mental health problems are the root cause and should be answered. Mass shootings have become commonplace in the United States. Since the beginning of 2023, more than 200 mass shootings have taken place in the country. Credible estimates show that nearly 15,000 people have died this year in gun violence incidents. In the wake of yet another mass shooting, U.S. President Joe Biden has called on Congress to pass gun control bills.
Yesterday, an assailant in tactical gear armed with an AR-15-style assault weapon gunned down innocent people in a shopping mall, and not for the first time. Such an attack is too shocking to be so familiar. We need more action, faster, to save lives.
The Democratic president renewed calls for Congress to ban assault weapons and high-capacity magazines, as well as to enact universal background checks and end immunity for gun manufacturers. Biden, who has made similar pleas before, said members of Congress cannot continue to meet the gun violence epidemic with a shrug. However, there is little chance the narrowly divided House and Senate would pass such legislation, although polls show most Americans support background checks. The U.S. Constitution's Second Amendment protects the right to bear arms, and that issue is a hot-button one for many Republicans who are backed by millions in donations from gun rights groups and manufacturers.
We are not anti-gun. We're not against the Second Amendment. You know, we believe that we must restore the responsibilities that go along with gun rights. There are other peer nations, high-income countries, that have high rates of gun ownership but low rates of gun violence. Those two things can coexist. What we have that no peer nation has is this wealthy, powerful special interest that's been allowed to write our nation's gun laws.
Firearms outnumber the population in the United States, where victims of gun violence are higher than any developed country.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
With the presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program of Viewpoints. I am Beta, the host of today's episode, and here with me there are two dear guest speakers, Brother Ali and Brother Hassanin. Assalamu alaikum, brothers.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So, as you know, we talked about one of the most important essential issues of the Islamic world, about the condition of Palestinian people in Palestine. We had several programs in this viewpoint, I don't know, about the struggles, the problems, the issues that these kind of Palestinian people are going through. And also, we talked about why we have to help these kind of people in need and what are the responsibilities of Islamic Ummah in these issues. So, in today's episode, we're going to talk about some special point of view and dimension of this issue and the lessons, you know, the things that we can learn from all these dramas, these kind of accidents and incidents, and these sufferings. You know, we are watching a scene of suffer, of beauty, and so many things. And I want you to elucidate this beauty and the lesson of this scene that we are watching.
Yeah.
Brother Ali,
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yeah. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. You ask about the lessons that we could take from the Palestinian issue, or the greatest issue in the Islamic Ummah, which is the issue of Palestine.
Yeah.
We have actually witnessed for last 7 decades what happened to the Palestinians, from the massacre, from the violence, from the waves of suffocation and waves of violence on these people, bloodshed, and whatever has come to these people. The worst ways of massacre of people has been seen and witnessed in this area. And we have seen the killing of even kids and babies, and too many scenes of wretchedness that has been reported by this regime on this occupied land. But the lessons that we can take from the whole story are even more important than what happened there. The ways that the lessons that actually led to the change of a great decision in the minds of the people to change their approach towards the Zionist regime. That is, from the time that they started with stoning them and the stones, and let's say stone battle, to a missile battle these days. So they have found out their ways. I mean, the people understood what in what ways they need to revive and to get back to their own motherland and to take back their own rights. So these lessons, though actually were taken from bitter lessons, but they are important and worthy of actually acting upon them. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that وَلَنَبْلُوَنَّكُمْ بِشَيْءٍ مِنَ الْخَوْفِ وَالْجُوعِ وَنَقْصٍ مِنَ الْأَهْوَالِ وَالْأَنفُسِ وَالثَّمَرَةِ وَبَشِّرِ الصَّابِرِينَ. After all these catastrophes that happened and came to the people, to the Palestinians. So Allah, at the end of this holy verse, actually gives good tidings to the believers that وَبَشِّرِ الصَّابِرِينَ. Tell the patients, tell the patient that give them the good tidings, and they should be waiting for a good news at the end of the day. So we are seeing the kind of change that is flourishing in the action, in the activities of the youth of Palestinians, what we couldn't see, for example, 4 decades ago.
Yeah.
I mean, 40 years ago, but we see it today. So this kind of changing the approach and the retaliation of whatever happens that very quickly right after any event, so it means a good lesson has come to people. They learned that negotiations called, I don't know, entitled as peace negotiations, I don't know, negotiations for...
Peace talks
are not working anymore.
Yeah.
Because they have seen the results. Different kinds of talks that they had in Egypt, in Palestine, in America, in Geneva. So they understood that they are useless because they have seen the fruit of those talks and it works no more. They understood that in order to survive, in order to take their right back, they need to actually create a sense of a morale of jihad inside the whole Islamic Ummah rather than themselves. And in case some in last generation made mistakes and actually accepted cooperation with the Zionist entity, so they are now actually changing their mind into in a defensive manner. So I think it is a great change that had happened, and these lessons are more important than the violence that came to these people earlier, and the massacre that. So every society, in order to find his life, needs to sacrifice something. So they sacrifice quite a lot.
Yeah.
And now, inshallah, for the reward of that sacrifice that they had, Allah will, inshallah, give them some good tidings with the new change and new approaches that they have in their strategies, in their fightings and in the battlefront. Hopefully, inshallah, they are very, very close to the victory.
Inshallah. Thank you, brother, for your explanation. You mentioned something really important that I want to clarify more. You talked about that point that they talked to Israel and then they negotiated. There were ways like these in the past that we got to this point and this lesson that this is meaningless and useless to negotiate with these people, with Israel, and so on. And this is more of an illusion of hope to just coexist with these people.
Very true.
Why is it so, Brother Hassani?
As Brother Ali has already mentioned about the, he's given a pretty much good introduction about the Palestinian cause. I feel like, you know, first of all, getting back to the previous question, that what are the lessons that we can learn?
Yeah.
So we see all this resistance and uprising of the Palestinian people from so many years. One of the main lessons, which is in fact can be called, we can rather I would say as a victory, is that, you know, these uprising of the Palestinian people have ruined the calculations of the Israel.
Yeah.
You know, over the period of time, over all these years of oppressing the people, Israel thought that they would be successful, that, you know, the people, after being oppressed for a long period of time, they'll lose the energy, they'll lose the determination, and henceforth they will be able to occupy the land. But you know, you see, when you see this amount of resistance again and again, continuously, consecutively, you don't see any resting in between. So that puts Israel under pressure. So the lesson is, we have to never lose hope.
Yeah.
This is the hope and the determination of the people that they're still fighting back. So this fighting back is still, you know, is still pressurizing Israel. So, you know, fighting back is, you know, as Israel thought that they would, you know, lose energy and they would set them aside.
For
but
sure.
This never happened because of the continuous resistance. And talking about the peace talk,